You go to the hospital with the hopes of getting treatment that will make you better. But hospitals and nursing homes have become breeding grounds for drug-resistant bacteria that can infect patients. A study released in October found that nearly 94,000 patients in the U.S. in 2005 developed antibiotic-resistant bacterial infections known as MRSA, or MRSA, an acronym for methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. Nearly one in five of these patients died. When my guest, Dr. Richard Shannon, was the chairman of medicine at Allegheny General, he led a study on the costs of hospital-acquired infections and initiated practices to try to limit their spread. Now, preventing hospital-acquired infections is one of his goals in his position as chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania Health System. Dr. Shannon, in that recent study that said that 85% of these resistant infections are associated with healthcare treatments, and one out of five of people who get these MRSA infections die, I'm thinking, well, if I need surgery, I'm afraid to go to the hospital because these infections are so prevalent in the hospitals, and one out of five people who get them die. That's not very encouraging. So what advice would you have for anyone who is facing a surgical procedure?
Well, first of all, the recent study really talks about the total spectrum of these resistant strains of called MRSA. And so hospital infections, as you say, are about 85% of those. But in the overall spectrum of all illnesses, this is still a relatively small issue. I think what's striking about it is it's preventable. And the need to rededicate ourselves to its prevention is really what's most important. That one out of five people die of a MRSA infection when they get one of these is truly remarkable. But I think also has to be considered in the context that these are usually patients that are sick with other illnesses. What they can't afford is to then get an infection. So I think the mortality is high because these were already sick patients with renal failure or heart failure or other organ system failure, which when they get this final resistant infection is really the straw that breaks the camel's back.
So how do these bugs get into your system when you're in the hospital? Or how can they get in? I want to make it seem like they always get in, but how can they get in?
Well, first of all, in many cases, these bacteria are resident within the patient even when they're not in the hospital. So about 3% of the population in the United States carries MRSA or methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, usually in their nose. And it frequently causes no problem. But when they get in the hospital and they're otherwise sick, that bacteria can then enter their bloodstream or enter their lungs and cause a significant pneumonia. Then you have all these procedures that occur, like intravenous lines that get placed or surgical procedures, violation of the barriers that usually protect you against these organisms. You come in contact with them in open wounds, for example, or through urinary tract catheters, and all of a sudden they have entry into the blood and can cause serious infection.
And then two doctors and nurses can spread it to you. How do they do that?
That's right. So the other interesting thing about these bacteria is not only do they live normally within the human body, but they are actually very hardy and can live outside the human body on surfaces that are inert, like the tray that's used in the room to serve you lunch, or on the stethoscope of your doctor or nurse, potentially even on the curtain that surrounds the bed. So these organisms can be passed from a human being to these inert objects and reside there pretty hardily, and therefore constitute a second reservoir or source, if you will, of spread of bacteria.
Now, you first became really deeply involved in this when you were working at Allegheny Hospital in Pittsburgh, and there was an outbreak of hospital-acquired infections. Was this in the cardiac unit where you were working?
The first time I got actively involved in this actually was an outbreak of a contaminated bronchoscope. So this was a piece of equipment that actually turned out to be contaminated with bacteria. And actually, it was a fairly widespread problem in the hospital that first got me engaged in this notion of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. But then I think the second part came when I began to experience, even in my own practice, patients whose lives were really altered by infections that they didn't come into the hospital with.
So what were the first steps you took to try to change this and prevent hospital-acquired infections?
So I think the first step that any leader in a hospital has to take today is ownership of this problem. One of the things that historically I think has led to slow progress in this area is that frequently these infections are reported in these very vague terms, such as, you know, 10 infections per 1,000 hospital days. And while that's an epidemiologically correct way to describe the frequency, it doesn't tell you anything about the human consequences. So I had a patient who came into the hospital that had a central line. He was actually waiting for a heart transplant, and that central line became infected. He had to be taken off the transplant list and 17 days later died. Here's a man that had waited 2.5 years for a heart, the hope for his future, only to have that taken away by something that arguably was preventable.
The central line, this is like an IV line.
It's like an IV line, exactly. So very commonly employed in hospitals. So seeing that firsthand in someone that I had cared for and recognizing that this didn't have to happen provide a compelling moral imperative for me to learn more about how to make care more reliable and prevent these unsafe conditions.
Well, you're now chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania Health Systems. That's like three hospitals. What are your hospitals doing to try to prevent the spread of hospital-acquired infections?
So building upon the traditional experience that we've had at Penn, there are really three new steps that we are taking specifically to address this issue. The first is to put a human face to these infections so that each individual healthcare provider owns this problem. I think one of the barriers has been that when we report these infections in complex numbers, no one feels responsible. It's as if this is an anonymous circumstance. So instead of saying we have 5.1 infections per 1,000 line days, we're saying we had 15 people that had a central line infection. And we're telling those 15 stories to all healthcare providers so that they understand the human consequences of what to them may seem to be relatively benign problems. So putting a face and decoding the data is the first step. The second step is we're working with all our staffs, particularly in the ICU and on the oncology units, where the consequence of these infections can be very severe, to observe their work and to actually figure out where there are defects in the current delivery of care that may propagate into an error. Now, it's rare that any one little glitch will create a hospital-acquired infection. But if several processes go awry and are not recognized, it's usually that set of circumstances that can lead to one of these infections. So we're trying to have our staff, our nurses in particular, see with new and different eyes these defects.
What's the third prong of your approach?
So the third element is that when we encounter an infection, we solve to root cause why it happened that day. So historically, infections are reported months after they occur, losing the context for any learning about what happened. Whenever there's a possible infection, I actually get an email message from the infection control people, and I go to the bedside with the care providers, and we don't ask who did it, we ask what happened, so that we have a rich context for learning. And in doing so, two things happen. One is you can fix what you learn went wrong, and you can say to the patient and their family, you know, we're really sorry this happened, but we figured out why, and I want you to know it can never happen again because we fixed it now.
Give me an example of something that you discovered by doing that.
So one of the things we discovered was that in the middle of the night, a catheter that a patient, an intravenous line that a patient had in got kinked. It bent and it wasn't working. And rather than removing it and putting a new one in, one of the medical staff actually just tried to put some alcohol at the site and push the catheter back into the skin. They did that because they didn't feel comfortable putting in a new catheter. So what we said was, anytime a catheter becomes defective, you call the pulmonary fellow who can fix this problem expertly and don't try and fix it yourself. And in doing that, we've not ever again had another problem with an infection related to a kinked catheter.
We're talking about how to stop the spread of hospital-acquired infections with Dr. Richard Shannon, chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania Health System. Stopping these infections became his special interest in his previous position at Allegheny General Hospital in Pittsburgh. There's some real basic things that doctors or nurses need to do, like washing their hands. Are you confident that in most American hospitals, doctors and nurses wash their hands each time they see a new patient?
I think that doctors and nurses are engaging in regular hand hygiene much more commonly. But are they doing it 100% of the time? No. And what my point would be is they must do it 100% of the time. In order to do that, we have to make that process simply a part of their work. So let me give you an example. When a doctor walks into the OR, he or she must put on scrubs. You couldn't get into an OR without scrubs. 100% of the time when someone goes into the OR, they're wearing scrubs. That same sort of highly reliable process must apply to hand hygiene.
Now, in the UK, they just put in new rules to try to prevent hospital-acquired infections. And it's kind of like an elaborate – well, not that elaborate – dress code. Doctors can't wear ties. They can't wear long sleeves. They can't wear jewelry or watches. What's the logic behind that?
Well, I think the concept is that when you lean over a patient to examine them, frequently your tie, as in my case, might brush against their gown. And if you didn't know that their gown might carry the organism, you could inadvertently then carry that to the next patient. I think the UK, much like the United States, is suffering from a really serious epidemic of these antibiotic-resistant organisms. So I think what the UK is trying to do is to make it such that any contact between a doctor and a patient, whether or not the patient has one of these organisms, is done in a way that maximally protects the chance that the doctor could walk away with the bacteria and transmit it to another patient.
Now, you were mentioning to me before we started the interview that one of the things you did as a healthcare leader is to understudy to basically understudy Paul O'Neill, the former Treasury Secretary, back when he was the head of Alcoa, which is based in Pittsburgh, and you used to be at Allegheny Hospital in Pittsburgh. So what did you learn from Paul O'Neill and Alcoa about managing problems?
So what I saw at the start of this work was that we had lots of evidence but no good practices. And so I went to industry working with Paul O'Neill at Alcoa to see how Alcoa makes aluminum reliably and does so without anybody getting hurt. Alcoa is the safest place in the world to work. And that's because Paul O'Neill, as a leader, created conditions that made it such that the precondition of any task was that no one would get hurt. I was simply taken by the fact that industry is really committed to defect-free processes. And I thought I could learn something from industries that create reliable products and apply that to care delivery.
So what did you learn?
It was fascinating. I spent time at Alcoa, where I learned the Alcoa business model as to how they went about identifying any unsafe condition that might pose a risk to a worker. And then Paul O'Neill exposed me to the Toyota production system model, where I went to Georgetown, Kentucky, and I watched them make automobiles. And Toyota is the world's greatest manufacturer of automobiles because their processes are defect-free. And I watched how they relentlessly pursued excellence by doing processes the same way every time. And that said to me, if we went back to hospitals and we took the same approach to maintaining catheters in a person, we might be able to achieve similar sorts of very impressive results.
So what have you changed, for instance, with catheters?
So what we've done is we learned early on that much of the focus in infection prevention was on how you place the catheter. What we learned through our observations and borrowing the processes from Toyota was it was in maintaining the catheter. Once it was in, how'd you take care of it? And what we initially discovered was there weren't reliable processes in place by which nurses and others took care of catheters. So now it's very unambiguous, very clear to everybody where the catheter is in the person's body, what the condition of the catheter is every day. There's a specific person responsible each day for looking at that catheter site and making sure it's intact. And anytime there's a question, that's immediately kicked up to a higher level person who can make a decision about whether the catheter needs to come out or not. So identifying a highly reliable, unambiguous process in which everyone's responsibility is made clear creates a much more likely defect-free process during the course of that catheter being in place.
Dr. Shannon, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Dr. Richard Shannon is the chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania Health System. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.